if you wanted to be, if you want to be a studio engineer or a producer, you can go to music school. You can learn everything theoretically, but you're still going to start by making tea.
Okay, so welcome to a first on the Stage Left podcast, where we will be interviewing not one, but two guests together, where we're going to be exploring both sides of the fence for success in the music industry, because we're joined by the acclaimed producer and songwriter, Callum McColl, who's worked with the likes of Sinead O'Connor and Rufus Wainwright, and by his wife, Kerry Harvey Piper, who is on the board of Music Managers Forum. And between them, they co-own Red Grape Music Limited, which is an independent music company providing management, labels, publishing, recording and production services to artists. So today what we're going to do is we're going to shine a light on the full suite of skill sets that are required to most likely enable a musician to get to where they want to. Because as we probably know by now, just being a good guitarist or songwriter, for example, is just a fragment of what it takes. In addition, we're also going to discuss how to best compartmentalize artistic output and creative endeavors away from the kitchen table, because Callum is the son of folk legend Peggy Seeger, and his half-sister was the iconic Kirsty McColl. And of course, both Kerry and Callum are parents to a former guest on the Stage Left podcast, Fraser from Jungle and of Bombay Bicycle Club. So it's a pleasure to say that our guests today on the Stage Left podcast are none other than Kerry Harvey Piper and Callum McColl. Thanks for joining us today, both. How are you doing?
Hello.
Yeah. Hello, Chris.
How are you doing?
We're doing very, very well. And I'm going to come to you first, Kerry, because it's as we are recording this, this is the second lockdown in the UK that has just kicked in. And we're not going to make this too much of a coronavirus-centric episode, but I do think it's important. You know, you said recently in an interview that the Music Managers Forum has been very, very invaluable in this time. So I just wonder if you can elaborate on what the MMF is, its purpose, and how it supported others in this time.
The Music Managers Forum is a group of managers and it looks after the interests of managers. So every section of the music industry has its own, if you like, trade body who looks out for the interests of it. And Music Managers Forum does that for managers across all levels of management, from, you know, the biggest groups on the planet to managers who are just starting out, artists who are self-managing, and everything in between. So it's a fantastic organisation because they provide an amazing amount of material so that you can educate yourself. They run courses, they provide support, and they're a forum within which you can discuss any problems or management issues safely.
And is that for kind of all levels? So you kind of talked about it a little bit there. Would it be a case that you get someone who's managing, you know, a super group, you know, speaking to people who are self-managing themselves as well? And does that transfer of information translate effectively?
It does. And what I've found incredibly useful about it is that there's very little sense of I'm too big a manager to talk to a young manager, or, you know, somebody who might be managing a massive rock band feels it's completely valid to be talking to somebody who maybe manages a DJ or a producer or a folk artist. It's very, I'm just trying to think of what the word is. I was going to say eclectic, and it is eclectic, but it's also just supportive of all managers at all stages, with the idea that the more you educate managers and the more you give them a safe forum within which to discuss issues, the better future managers are going to be. And we're all learning from everybody else.
How have things evolved in the last kind of 10 years or so then in regards to the quantity of people who are managing themselves and actually employing managers, or the managers taking 20% cut or whatever it might be? Has that changed at all, or is it as it always was?
I don't know for sure, but my impression is that there are an awful lot more artists who are being self-managed, and an awful lot of artists who are getting managers at an earlier stage, because artists are becoming much more clued up as to who they need on their team. And one of the first people that you really need on your team is a good manager.
Absolutely. And I wonder if Callum's got some thoughts on this. How do you identify a good manager? So let's say I'm a young musician and I'm playing some gigs and people are starting to come to me and saying, oh, I'd like to manage you. You guys are good, or whatever it might be. what are the common pitfalls that I should avoid, and how do I trust someone in that situation?
Can I just say, when you said how do you identify a good manager, Kerry pointed to herself. I've got real I tell you. Well, Kerry's right. It's taken as read that there's a lot of good singers, there's a lot of good guitar players, keyboard players, drummers. I think the two of the hardest things to find in this industry are good managers and good writers. And for that reason, you know, I mean, good managers are very in demand. And by nature of what a manager does, you can't effectively manage more than 2-3 people at a time. Yes, you can have a stable, you can have a company, and you can oversee that. But that old style of 60s managers that hung people out of windows, that's a very personal way of doing it. So what makes a good one? One that listens, one that's pig-headed. Sorry, Kerry. One that listens, one that's pig-headed. I'm not airing my marriage here. One that's aware of what the artist wants to achieve rather than what they want the artist to achieve. And I think that's the really important thing. And it's a manager helps an artist to clarify all of that. A good manager does.
That's interesting. What's the manager's role if someone else within that kind of pool of people that are supporting the artist, perhaps of more authority, is saying, we want this particular record, or we want this particular thing we want the artist to do, and the artist is dead against that? Have you ever experienced that or know of that? And what's the role of the manager? Is that to back up the artist, or is it to implement what the more authoritative person in that situation wants?
Well, unless the manager is Donald Trump and completely mad. unless the artist is that, the manager backs up the artist generally.
Well, I'd also just jump in and say that the manager acts as the bridge between the artist and the rest of the team. So that might be the bridge between the artist and the label, or the artist and the publisher. Where the manager doesn't act as a bridge is between the artist and the fan and the audience. That's that relationship you don't get in the way of at all. You can help the artist direct that, and you can find ways for the artist to improve that, but you absolutely don't get in between that. Whereas a good manager is, if you like, the business face of the artist, and you're fighting the artist's corner all the time. That's your job.
That's good to know. And from your perspective, Kerry, so you pointed at yourself, as well as yourself and your own qualities as a good manager, what are other qualities that you've seen in other managers that maybe you'd like more of yourself, or that you admire, that might be something that I'm that musician that I'm, you know, starting out, I can kind of identify and think, okay, that's the kind of person I can trust, or this is the person I want to manage me.
Oh, God, where do I start with the managers that I admire and the qualities that I admire in them? I think one of the things that I just generally admire in other managers is the fact that we have to have a knowledge of the entire industry. There's nobody else really that has to understand publishing, has to understand labels, has to understand publishing deals and label deals, has to understand distribution deals, has to understand contracts. Of course, you'll always go to a lawyer, but
the narcissistic mindset of the artist as well.
Oh, yeah, that notwithstanding.
I put myself in that.
Oh, God, yeah. You have to understand where an artist is coming from. What is it that drives the artist? And I think the best managers have this quite rare combination of understanding the business side and all areas of the business side, and understanding the numbers, but also understanding what drives the artist, what's going to make the artist happy, how to help the artist get the best out of their career, how to motivate the artist when things are going badly, how to not hold them back when things are going well, but how to kind of...
Ground them.
How to ground them, yeah, perfect, yeah. So you kind of straddle these two completely different worlds, and... It's not.
I also think, Chris, I mean, you said you framed the question as to, if I was a young artist, what would I be looking for? I think there's a lot of things you're looking for, but you used it, the word yourself, the T word, trust. It's a basic human trust thing. There's a tendency of wish fulfillment, you know, of a manager promising you the moon and delivering you a small piece of rock. The trust thing is very, very important.
And so, I mean, it's a really difficult question, but, you know, bloody estate agents want you to trust them, right? So is it a case of recommendations, do you think young artists should look at, or you know, what constitutes trust? What does trust look like in those early stages?
Recommendations is a really important one. Reputation. Talk to other people. If I was a young artist and I was considering somebody as management, the first thing I would do is look at who else they'd managed and not be impressed or otherwise by their success or otherwise. I'd look them up and go and talk to them. I'd say, what were your experiences? Same as everything else in life. If that estate agent, you'd talk to other people in the area. You might not go to Trustpilot, but you'd talk to people.
I think the other thing is that a lot of, you know, most managers actually learn on the job. You don't go to management school. I mean, there are lots of courses that you can do at various of the music colleges, and you can do a course on music management. But most of the good managers have actually learned from the ground up. You know, you make it up as you go along. You're learning on the job. So, and I think that's where the trust issue comes in, because so many great managers have actually been started out as the artist's best mate or the artist's sister or brother. And the artist has grown and the manager's grown with the artist. You know, and there are loads of really good examples of that, because that trust bond is absolutely central, as Callum said. You know, you wouldn't trust anyone more than you trust your best friend or your sister or your brother. So sometimes if the trust is there in the first place and you've got somebody that you love and trust who's saying, I want to manage you, and you think they're, you know, bright enough and hungry enough and bloody minded enough to do the job, absolutely nothing
my
wrong.
Wife bloody minded. What you mean. To be honest, Chris, most jobs in this industry is making it up as you go along, learning on the job. You know, typically you can, if you want to be a studio engineer or a producer, you can go to music school, you can learn everything theoretically, but you're still going to start by making tea. You're going to still start with the shitty jobs because you have to learn, because virtually everything in this industry is a people-facing job. So it's learning about psychology, learning how to be a good person, learning how to be generous with other people.
That's really interesting, because that brings me over to, I wanted to explore some of these ideas of what are kind of some of the underrated skills or qualities a young musician needs, do you think, that they might just focus on, you know, practicing their bloody instrument, which is obviously great and we want to do that. But what are some of the overlooked or underrated skills or qualities you think a musician needs, maybe to thrive in the studio setting or live?
This is going to be a long list.
Go for it.
Patience, learning the value of failure, falling over in order to get up again, not expecting it to be a binary, something happens to you and you suddenly make it, learning to not create stuff for what you think people will like, but for what you think is important. Any more? There's loads more.
Learning to be polite to crew.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
Be nice.
Well, be a good person. Because it's that old way up, way down. People will be waving you down on the way down if you're shitty to people on the way up. And you have no right to as a human being. That's all part of the grounding. And to realise that if you are an artist or a musician, that it's a lifelong learning curve. You never stop learning if you're successful, if you're good. Every good musician and creator that I've ever met is continually learning, continually working out what they don't know.
Yeah, the pursuit in the gap of knowledge is actually probably a good mindset to have. So you touched upon kind of the continuous learning, continuous development there. Are you happy to share, have either of you ever had any kind of massive professional setback that like maybe hit you like a truck at the time and you thought, I'm not going to go over this, or really, you know, was a big challenge but ended up on reflection, been actually quite a good thing because you learn from it. Is it either example? Either of you got a good example?
Well, everyone learns from that. It's like everyone's life. You know, it's glass half empty, glass half full. Something bad happens because you're not going to get through this life without something bad happening. And the same things happen in your professional life. Yeah, shit happens. And it depends on how you react to it. And it's not, you know, then you will be a man, my son or a woman, my daughter. But it is how you react to it. I've certainly had those. I'm sure you have as well.
We had one, yeah. One specific one, which affected both of us actually at the same time, where Callum's very close friend and musical brother-in-arms, Colin Verncombe, who used to record under the name of Black, a massive hit in the 80s called Wonderful Life. Callum and Colin had been working together for years and years. And in about 2010, I started managing him. So we had this, you know, great unit. So Colin was a good friend. Callum was writing with him, touring with him, recording with him, and I was managing him. And over the course of 5 years, we really kind of reinvigorated things for him, got him back out touring, got him back out recording. Callum co-wrote an album with him. And then just as it all was starting to come together, Colin was killed in a car crash on the way to an airport to have a writing session for the next album. And that was a massive, massive blow. Mm. I mean, obviously, you know, the most dreadful thing that could possibly happen. And for us, it was not only losing a dear friend, but it was losing part of our job.
Yeah, it was devastating. But I think more widely, every musician eventually is going to lose their gig, lose the gig that they've got. If you're having a very successful career, at some point it will be less than very successful, because that's what life is. It doesn't mean that you're not any good or you've lost it or you can no longer play, but we're all human after all. So you will naturally go, it's me, I'm shit. I screwed up. I almost used another word. That's the human thing, which is why I said one of the things that young artists have to prepare for is failure. Failure is the most beautiful teacher.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. And where did that come into in regards to your philosophy when bringing up Fraser? So was that something that you instilled at a young age, or is it something just on reflection now that you've realised? Because as we kind of just before we recorded, you know, Fraser's like such a great guy, very, very level-headed, very reflective thinker. You know, it was really interesting to interview him last year when he came over.
I don't think that's our doing, actually.
Go on, take the credit.
Well, between us, we've got 6 kids. So, and they're all doing different things. Fraser and his identical twin brother, Harry, were the two who really showed an inclination to want to be musicians, to make that their living rather than it just being something for pleasure.
I mean, to be honest, Chris, I wanted a plumber, a lawyer, a builder,
a vet,
a doctor.
I've got an accountant.
That'd be a nice one. And I've got a bloody drummer and a guitar player. So, you know, I mean, I certainly, because I was on the road a hell of a lot when they were little. I was on the road most of the time. And I instilled in them that it's my thoughts, which was it's not in, apart from all those things about learning about failure and being nice, it's not enough just to be the guitar player. You can sing, learn to sing better. You can write, learn to write better. You can tour manage a bit. Just make yourself useful, because everyone, or most people, 99.9% of people in this industry have portfolio careers these days. So the more that you can turn your hand to, the more useful you are. And it also, you know, keys into that learning thing where you're constantly learning. And it's great because all of those skills inform each other. So I like to think that I kind of, I don't know, not rammed it down their throats, but the idea of MDing, because I've MD'd an awful lot, which is leading, because all you're doing when you're MDing is wearing the line tamer's hat. You're going, okay, I'm not necessarily the one with the answers, I might not be right, but let's hear what everyone's ideas with. We're going with her idea, because that's a really good idea. and you're the one that gets hung for it. You get paid a bit more for it, but it's a separate job. So we had all of that going on. I mean, they grew up in a house of music, so it's always an advantage to grow up in a house of music, because by the time you get to hold your first instrument, it's not an alien thing. It's, you've got a great big head start on the rest of the world.
That's how you grew up.
That's how I grew up. But really, it's teaching. I think it was actually, in terms of Fraser being a lovely, lovely guy, it's more that of that area that we're all aiming at as parents.
And I would just, I'm just going to, you know, put a word in for the rest of them, actually. They're all pretty lovely.
Yeah. So.
Very diplomatic of you. Actually, listening to you there, it triggered a memory of when I was researching the interview with Fraser, and a really unique thing out of all the people I've interviewed, he was the youngest person on their website to say, I'm a musical director, that I'd experienced. It was like, oh, right, huh, that's interesting. And so it kind of makes sense that you, a musical director, maybe, you know, influenced him to do that, or you know, that portfolio career idea, so you can, you know, do a number of different things. But yeah, I'd say that was the youngest person I've certainly come across who is doing that, which is really interesting. Now, given your upbringing, Callum, and you know, your family, kind of your family tree is really, really interesting. It's a bit of a basic question, but I'm interested in your thinking on this: nature or nurture?
50-50. I would always say 50-50. Nice illustration of that is when Fraser was first in bands, he was in his first signed band, Born Blonde. He was 19 or 20. Somebody came up to me at a Born Blonde gig afterwards and said, God, he really is yours, isn't he? Makes the same guitar faces as you. He looks exactly like you. He has the same stance on stage. It's in the blood. And I nodded and smiled. Fraser's my stepson. It's really interesting, all of that. And I think there's a tendency which pisses quite a lot of musicians off, which is, oh, it's all right for you. You grew up with it, as if there's no hard work involved. There's as hard work involved as for anyone else. So 50-50. That was a long way of saying 50-50.
So in regards to your development and your career, Callum, obviously your mother, legend in the world of folk music, if she'd had a job as an accountant, right?
Oh God, no!
What would your career be?
Don't trust your accounts with her. Is all you want. So.
But I mean, just to explore that idea, how it impacted your career path.
I don't know, because I've never known anything else. I've known what I've wanted to do from about the age of 14, and I wasn't that good. When I was 14, you were saying about Fraser and young MD. I mean, this generation are technically way better than my generation were. I've got no idea. I never knew anything else. It was just music, music, music. My dad wanted us all to go to university and become marine biologists and stuff. So we all rebelled and all five of us became musicians. But I have no idea, honestly, Chris. You know, as I was saying to somebody the other day, if... would consider myself an artist, and if you're an artist, it's not what you do, it's what you are. So it just wouldn't occur to me being anything else.
So you talked about the idea of your parents saying kind of around the marine biologist and all that kind of stuff as a joke. What, given that you'd grown up and lived from kind of, you know, your embryonic stages within the music industry, was there any part of you that would want someone like Fraser to not go into that industry?
Christ, yeah. I mean, I didn't make a proper living until really my mid-20s, mid to late 20s. And, you know, you're surrounded by your peers going, oh, you're so lucky. And they're putting their deposit on their first flat. And it's like, oh, really? Can I swap with your luck for a minute? It really does feel like, you know, it's a real slog, and it's harder now than it's ever been. It's still fantastic, and it's fantastically rewarding. But yeah, I'd have wanted to swap places many, many times. But it was that feeling that a lot of musicians have, which is, oh, it's all I can do. All I know.
And Kerry, from your perspective, working with family and business, that's like rule number one. Actually, my dad taught me. He said, never go into business with your own family. So that, you know, that must be challenging. How do you compartmentalise that?
I think over the years I've got quite good at remembering which hat I'm wearing, because when I first started in the music industry, it was setting up a label, a small independent label, which I knew nothing about and kind of learned from scratch. and then became a manager to one of the artists that we got signed to the label. So I had to constantly remember which hat I was wearing. Am I the label today or am I her manager? And it took me a while to work out that actually it didn't really matter what hat you were wearing, as long as you were wearing the hat that benefited the artist. Because as a manager, if you do something that's good for the artist, you know, that's good for you as a manager. As a label, if you do something that's good for the artist, that's good for you as a label. So when I started working with Callum's mum, Peggy, and got involved and started managing her, I mean, she'd been my mother-in-law for quite a long time before I became her manager. And we had a good relationship. It was, you know, we've always got on really well. But I think one of the things that I said to her was that if the managing gets in the way of our relationship as family, then I'll step back from managing because, you know, I'd rather just keep being her daughter-in-law than being her manager.
Yeah, Kerry, you do a very good job. I mean, we've had perverse situations over the years, Chris. I mean, it's several times I've produced albums for artists that Kerry's managing and found myself at the kitchen table, not in the bedroom, never in the bedroom, at the kitchen table, haggling with my wife, with whom I hold a joint account. And she's haggling me down and down and down, and I'm haggling her up, and it's like we're having a Mexican standoff.
Yeah, because, you know, if I think he's overcharging on his production fees, I'm absolutely going to haggle him down.
There's no sleeping with the manager that gets you any favours. I'll tell you that for nothing. It just doesn't work.
I mean, it must be challenging to, I mean, so a lot of people right now are adapting to working from home. And there's an interesting phrase I heard the other day, which is actually we're not working from home now, we're living from work or living at work, if you like. And it must be very, very challenging. Is there one tip you can give either of you in regards to how you draw that line or pull down that curtain and go, right, enough of work now, you know, we're back to being a family, and how not a row about work or a disagreement or a discussion about, you know, a decision, how that doesn't bleed over to kind of when you're sitting in front of the TV at night or whatever you might be doing in the evening?
Well, I think a lot of people in lockdown are finding, or if you're listening to this and we're in the halcyon blue days of post-lockdown, did find this whole trying to negotiate a work-life thing at home. And my reaction has been to that, welcome to my world, because I'm sitting here in my studio, which is converted double garage. I actually know somebody who lives in a similar situation to this, who blocked up the door to the house, made a door to the outside, and made it an iron rule for himself that every day he'd go out of the door, rain, snow, or shine, and walk round the block to get into the studio to have that mentally getting away from. It can be very hard, and I think a lot of people are finding that, you know, oh, I'm not working hard enough. And that comes on top of pre-lockdown, a world where people are encouraged to work 24/7 anyway. It's tough.
I think the other thing, I mean, for us personally, we always had an iron rule that work talk stopped at the bottom of the stairs so that no work was carried up either physically or mentally or emotionally upstairs. So there's that complete barrier.
No haggling.
No haggling.
It's interesting you said emotionally there, because I was thinking that, because, yeah, you could say, right, okay, we're not going to talk about it once we get past the bottom of the stairs, but you might still be pissed off about something. So how do you, what's any tips? I mean, maybe there aren't, maybe it's just getting used to it and living with it, but any particular tips to draw that line emotionally then, rather than just proximity to a staircase?
I think it's just practice, and we've got better at it as, you know, as the years have gone on. I mean, one of our youngest daughter used to get really, really pissed off with music talk at the dinner table. You know, we'd all be sitting around having supper and it would turn to music because you go around the table, go, how was your day? How was your day? How was your day? And of course, you know, me and Callum and, you know, once the kids were starting to leave school, Fraser and Harry were working in music. So, you know, that's four out of the six or seven people sitting around the table whose day involves music. And, you know, the others were kind of just get to the stage where going, excuse me,
yeah,
you know, we can't,
someone else,
we can't join in this conversation because it's rapidly getting technical or very specific. and it wasn't of interest to the others. So, you know, our youngest, Ella, was absolutely right to say, I'm going to ban music talk at the dinner table. And it most, well, did it work? No, not always, but
I think also, you know, it keys back into your advice for young artists, which is don't take it all personally. It's just haggling. People are haggling. It's fine. It's not personal. They're not actually attacking you as a human being.
It's only music.
It's only music. It's only, in a sense, it's business. So it's fine. You know, if we ran a draper's shop, we might disagree about, you know, what textiles we wanted to buy. But, you know, you shut the shop and get on with your life and cook dinner and it's fine. Talking of which, this is prosaic. I've just got to go and put the oven on. I'll be back in a sec.
Okay. We'll take a break for a moment. We'll take a break for a moment in that case. So, Callum, let's talk producing, because we often ask artists how they feel sometimes writing a song which they see as their baby and handing it over to a producer, and the delicacy of that transition, if you like, of the song or the product, and where it goes from there. You must be aware of that as a producer yourself. So how do you navigate that so that you are aware of the delicacy and the sensitivities around that?
It depends what your style is and what sort of production you're doing. I mean, if you're in dance world where really you're going to skim the top line off and, you know, you're looking for a few hooks from it and, you know, you really are just looking for top line hooks, it's a whole different sort of production than the singer-songwriter that comes in and has some kind of sound in their head. Proceeding with sensitivity, I think you have to, again, it's a bit like the management thing, you have to start by winning people's trust, to keep telling them that it is their record and keep telling them that it's your job to challenge them. It is your job to kind of pick holes in it and not pick it to death. You're not picking the life out of it. But, you know, there's certain things that you see, and certainly certain things that I see when I start on a project with a bunch of songs. I mean, where you kind of go, that one's stronger than that one needs a bit of editing, that's lyrically a bit sloppy, could do with, and it's really that encouraging the artist that they can do better, that actually what they've done is really good. It's a, you know, 80% really good idea, but it may not be a finished song yet. Sonically, I have difficulty with this. Oh yeah, I'm going to the producer and they've got a vision. I don't think it works like that particularly. It's certainly not the way that I do it. I kind of like to tease out what's there and work out where the artist wants to go with it, what their references are. But you have to proceed, I think, with great sensitivity. At the same time, you do need to challenge people. They're coming to you, they're paying you because they need challenging. They want to find more than they can do themselves.
An extension of that then is, can you think of any examples of, and it might be from yourself or other people you've known who've been in that situation, that a technique a producer has created to really enhance the performance or really get the best out of the performer? You know, maybe someone's having red light syndrome, whatever it might be, but anything that's really, really enhanced the confidence in for the artist in that moment?
Confidence is a funny thing. You know, I can think of plenty of examples, but nothing that really nails that. Singing's a really interesting one. I mean, I often do vocals here because I actually set a mic up in the other room because it doesn't look like a studio. And again, you know, it's being very sensitive, and by the point that you're getting to doing vocals, you really should know the artist quite well and they should know you quite well. There should be a real bond of trust there so that I can immediately hear how relaxed somebody is, if they're relaxed, not relaxed. I've got pretty good at playing a mix to people while they're recording, and they might think, a lot of singers think they want their vocals really loud with loads of reverb, and you'll nod and make it really loud with loads of reverb, slowly back the reverb off, pull it down, and suddenly they start singing, so they're pushing the right amount. There's lots of tricks like that, but it's really about relaxation. Great music is relaxed. You know, even if it's music that's full of angst, it's relaxed. It's made in a relaxed way to access that stuff that is unpredictable. But there's plenty of tricks. I mean, one thing that came just randomly into my head, there's a tendency with artists that have grown up in the part of the Pro Tools generation, and I'm old and grizzled enough to have grown up with tape, of endless takes, endless redos, endless fixes. One thing I did in a production, a youngish band with Phil Brown, the legendary engineer, and we were recording to Pro Tools, and we said, we're only keeping three takes. And they couldn't believe it. They said, but we can keep 10 takes. Yeah, but we're only keeping three. We got to this point where we had three. We got them into the control room. We got them to throw away two and keep one. They went back in and they were a different band. They suddenly started to perform because now was the only moment there is. There's lots of little tricks. There's lots of little tricks that you can employ. I'm sure that doesn't answer your question.
It does. I mean, and also, do you think with... I'm really glad you do that because it does increase the intensity and there can be a flabbiness, if you like, for want of a better word, of just knowing that you can do another take and it doesn't necessarily have that intensity. Also, I wonder if, you know, you might lose a bit of the charm in modern day recordings because you don't get the errors and the mistakes that sometimes give a little bit of character. So like Desolation Row by... Bob Dylan has got like, there's a couple of bits, it's a 10-minute song, it's in one take with the guitarist kind of doing a call and response. And there's a couple of like bum notes in there, which actually give it a bit of character. But today, do another take.
Correct it all out of there. That's very, very true. Which is why I say you've got to be open to the random. You've got to be open to random stuff. And yeah, it's very hard not to correct mistakes. Really hard to do it. But it's also hard to engineer in stuff that is musically, quote, wrong, unquote. But it needs the musical wrongness, and that's what you're talking about. You're talking about a bit of wrongness in there. Unfortunately, a lot of people are conditioned, for the radio oneness of our world, they're conditioned to hearing everything squeaky, which isn't that healthy.
So producers today are more likely to get songwriting royalties than perhaps in the past. Is that right? Is that fair? Is that now a good thing that producers are getting the credit they deserve, or does that take something away from, does it almost become a bit of a fight to see how much input I can have on this particular song? I wonder if you ever experienced that or know of that.
Yeah, it's an enormous question. That's an enormous question. And you have to do it on a case-by-case basis, really. I think it's a little over-egged. I think the idea that, oh, yeah, I wrote that bass line. It's a bass line sometimes, unless it's the bass line that defines the song. That's where the whole, you know, kind of Baker Street, Raff Ravenscroft legal case was, is the hook. So, but there's nothing that you can kind of nail down legally that says one thing or the other. I think in the case certainly of dance music, producers absolutely deserve a writing credit because it just wouldn't exist in that form. I think if you're recording something that somebody else has written and you throw in a couple of chords, I don't take publishing on that. Changing chords, you know, suggesting a different change or a modulation or taking a modulation out. No, that, it's not a big enough change to me. If it's radical and you've written a verse, yeah.
And I think the other thing with that is that, you know, obviously, you know, producers get points on an album. And there's less money. There's less money that that album's going to make now, generally, kind of across the board. I'm not talking about massive albums.
Well, that's the thing. Producers don't really take points on albums anymore because it's meaningless.
It can be meaningless, or you're not going to get accounted to by the label, or, you know,
or both.
You know, it's not going to recoup, and, you know, nobody did the producer's contract from record one, so... So I think from a producer's point of view, they're protecting their interests. From a management point of view, absolutely bloody not. No.
So I was going to bring this up then. So let's say I'm that young musician who I've now got a manager and I'm going into the studio and I'm just a singer-songwriter, not just, but a singer-songwriter with a guitar and vocals. And I think, oh, I'd like a bit of piano on this. I'd like, you know, different instruments that might become more and more prominent in the song. How do I navigate that conversation? So A, I'm not exploited, but also I'm not being a complete dictator about things.
That's a really, really good question.
I mean, my answer to that is, well, the simple answer is agree the deal before a note is recorded. You know, it's a bit like with song you know, if, with songwriting, you know, if, you know, if you agree that everybody in the room is going to have an equal part of that song, but you have to say that right at the beginning. And yeah. I think it's the same with going into a studio with a producer, or even just going into pre-production with a producer. You have to have that conversation, and it's part of the education of artists to not be squeamish about having that conversation, because so many artists won't. It might be because they don't know. It might be because they feel uncomfortable about it. A young artist might be going in with a seasoned producer and kind of not have the courage to say something. Mm-hmm. But it's always about having the conversation.
Yeah. I mean, you have that in songwriting situations. I mean, most people, most of the time, do the right thing. Songwriting situations, most people take it as read that you're going along the Nashville kind of model, which is you're in the room, you write a song with two people, it's 50-50. And you don't get somebody squealing afterwards, yeah, but I wrote most of the words. So it wouldn't have come about unless there was two people in the room. I think with production, you know, and Kerry touched on it, because there's no money in points anymore, there's no royalties there, I think there's more of a need, or producers perceive more of a need to take some of the publishing. But as Kerry said, you have to, whether that's right or wrong, you have to sort it out beforehand.
It's like a prenuptial.
It is a prenup, and you can't afterwards say, yeah, but I didn't get paid very much for this, therefore I want the publisher. Yeah, well, you didn't say that.
And prenups are always much cheaper than a divorce.
They are, yeah.
Absolutely.
that's really interesting. Yeah, thank you for delving into that. I mean, the other question that screams out to me, and you just kind of refer to, you know, we've already talked about some big questions here, but who sets the rules? Like, it's a case by case basis, which I get, but to what criteria are we working to here? So, like, you know, could there be a case that one person plays a bass part that is just as prominent as another song, and one person gets kind of nothing for it, and the other person gets kind of really well rewarded for it? Can that happen? And who's setting those rules? It feels like there should be some kind of standardizations that we can at least work towards, or doesn't work like that?
No, it doesn't, because it's art, isn't it? I mean, it's so subjective. I mean, you think of a song like Tainted Love, where it's a production call to have the bam, bam, do, 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 bam, bam. And it's a great vocal performance and all of that, but that's what made it a hit. Mm. But the producer at that time would have got their points and they'd have made a tidy sum just from the physical points that they had on it. And there was no publishing fight in that yet. The Baker Street thing, there was a fight in that. Samples obviously is a different thing, because it's clearly actually originated from somebody else's work. But no, there isn't an easy answer. There's no easy formula to this.
And I think the whole industry in general is that there is no such thing as standard.
No.
And
I've met plenty of people in this industry where there's no such thing as standards.
Oh, there's plenty of those.
Yeah, we've all met them.
In so many cases, it's, you know, what seems right, what can you get away with, what makes everybody happy, what's the conversation you had to start with, and just agree at the top. I mean, you can't cover everything right from the top, or you'd spend hours going, you know, before you went into a studio negotiating every single point, and that there has to come a point where you just go, right, we'll do this, and we'll work it out as we go along.
You're right, and sorry to cut across you, but 90% of the really acrimonious situations that we've been not in but party to, where it's generally young artists that wind up in an acrimonious situation, 90, possibly 99% of them boil down to not having that conversation beforehand. And as a culture, we're very squeamish about money. We're very squeamish about just laying it on the line, but it has to be done.
Really interesting. Some kind of, you know, support around how to have delicate conversations or difficult conversations would really help.
I mean, people aren't taught that, are they? They're not.
When our kids left school and got jobs and we're still living at home, we worked on the 20% principle, that 20% of their net income was actually put on, you know, put on the kitchen table as, you know, money to the household. And we were really upfront about it. And the number of other parents that we talked to who kind of went, I don't want to have that conversation. You know, want to be supportive of our kids. And we're going, no, have the money conversation.
Part of their education.
Be upfront about it. And then everyone knows where they are.
Yeah.
I've been accosted at a party by another mother who came running up to me and said, I've just been told that you charge your children 20% to live in your house. I was like, well, it's not quite like that.
So you talked earlier about, you know, some of the challenges around being in the music industry. And I really like the idea, Callum, you said about the binary. It's not like you just do stuff and then you've made it. And, you know, the fluid is kind of different shades of grey, if you, for want of a better phrase. What's the price you both pay for this job? So it seems like quite a glamorous role that you have in both, you know, parts of the industry. What's the price you pay? Which we know, you know, I think most of my listeners now, you know, that whatever level you're at, it's never quite exactly what it looks like from the outside. So what's the price you pay for the job that you do?
Oh, that's an unusual question.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Chris. Crappy secondhand cars.
Yeah.
Very few foreign holidays.
No, I think you're overplaying that. You're overplaying that a bit. I mean, it's a different thing. It's like any kind of being self-employed is it's rocky. And as lockdown proves, or proved if you're listening to this after, yeah, we're on the front line. Well, no, the NHS is on the front line, but financially we're on the front line. We seem to be expendable. And, you know, I kind of resent the fact that throughout my, I'm 57 years old, throughout my whole life, art has been looked at as some kind of luxury, and successive governments cut it in schools and it's the first thing that goes. So, yeah, you feel very vulnerable. You feel very vulnerable working within the arts because you know that you're only a few feet from the abyss at any point.
Yeah, powerful stuff. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so what's the most important piece of music memorabilia that you own, or something that you have that if the house was burning down and everyone was safe, it could be something on a laptop that's stored somewhere, whatever it might be, but what's something that's actually really important to you that has some kind of significance that you would try and grab?
Oh, that's a tough one as well.
Well, given that we're sitting, while we're talking to you, we're sitting in a studio surrounded by rather a large number of guitars.
Yeah, it would have to be my Gretsch for me, which isn't memorabilia. It's just, it's a lovely, lovely guitar. My 65 Gretsch is just a lovely, lovely thing. And I've had it for so long and it's a mate of mine. I'm not really a big one for memorabilia. I've been lucky enough to make a couple of, or be involved in a couple of platinum and gold records. And, you know, it's a bit kind of weird putting those up around the house. And in the end, it doesn't really mean that much. The guitar means a lot, though, that guitar.
Most have quite a strong relationship and bond with a guitar, so I hope you're not too jealous there, Kerry. What about from your perspective, Kerry? Is there anything that, or something you're proud of, something that you know, this means something to me in some way in relation to music?
Before I answer that, I'll just give you an anecdote in that when Callum buys a guitar, he has a particular "I've bought a guitar" face. And he came home one day, I think he'd been at a session, and he came in through the front door, and I just took one look at him and just went, "Where is it?" And he went, "What? What?" He said, "Oh, I've just been on a session." I went, no, "Where is it?" And he kind of then reached back behind the front door and went, oh, this old thing that I just happened to pick up from a guitar shop close to the studio.
Yeah, all right, yeah, sixth sense. So what are you going to save in Melbourne, of course, apart from the 600 pairs of shoes?
Okay, what am I going to save? Do you know what? I can't think of any one piece of music memorabilia. I think my phone with all the kind of rubbishy shots of that I've taken on tour, and of just kind of, you know, whether we've been in the van or at gigs, or I've been standing on the merch table, you know, looking at the band on stage and kind of going, I really love my job. I'd miss those pictures, actually, because on those moments where you're just standing there going, I'm part of this. I made this happen. I'm not making it happen on stage. You know, the guys on stage are doing that. But if I hadn't been involved, this wouldn't have happened in the same way. And I get that intense sense of pleasure and pride and achievement when I'm standing watching a gig that's going well. I mean, not when a gig's going crap, because then I start thinking, Christ, I've got to go and do something now. But that, yeah, all those really bad, out of focus, too dark photos of...
That's brilliant. The phone's really small, so you can carry my Telecaster as well. So it's
I've got one of those in the wardrobe, actually. Quick question off the back of that. If there was one gig, each of you, and have a think about this for a second, if there's one gig you could re-experience, what would it be? You know, and that could be, Callum, from your perspective, it could be on stage, but or it could actually be from the audience. But if you go back and re-experience one gig, what would it be?
For me, it would... Oh, let's try and work out the date. Would have been about... 1995, 96 in Tokyo with Eddie Reader. And it was just the most fantastic gig. And remember that we'd started with this Tim Buckley song called Dolphins. And I suddenly came to, you know, when you get, sometimes you're just so lost in it. And there's this big clock at the other end of the hall. And we were 10 minutes into this version. It was the first song of the set. And I looked around at the band and everyone was completely lost in it, and looked at the audience. They were totally lost in it. And just for a moment, I'd woken up before I let myself go back into it. And it's just the most amazing feeling in the world. Sorry, it's a bit like Desert Island Discs and playing one of your own records. The gig that it's like, you know.
I can totally appreciate how that would be an amazing feeling. And Kerry, probably from your perspective, it would be from side of stage or out in the audience. What's one that springs to mind for you?
Actually, I think it was a Santana gig at Hammersmith Odeon, as was Apollo, as now, when I was 16, I think. My boyfriend at the time was the son of the promoter. And so instead of watching the gig from out front, we watched from backstage. And it was the first time I'd been backstage at a really big gig. And I just went, you know what? I don't really want to ever watch a gig from out front again. I want to watch it from backstage. I want to be part of this, because it's an awful lot more interesting.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Great example there. So you know how we all kind of look back on our youth.
What about you, Chris?
A gig that I would re-experience. I think about this all the time. There's so many. So you both know Clive Deamer quite well, don't you?
Yeah.
I think, yeah. So we were staying with him and Lisa recently. So hello to both those who will be listening. And
hello, Lisa. Hello, Clive.
Yeah.
They'll be really pleased to get the mention, I think. So I don't want to say, Radiohead at Glastonbury like 3 years ago was, and there's a reason for it. And I have discussed this with Clive in quite a lot of detail, that for me, when I've seen Radiohead a number of times in the past, Tom almost comes across as if he doesn't really want to play the old songs. That's just from the audience perspective. And I get that. Like maybe he feels a bit slightly divorced from those songs, different era now. And I said to Clive, I said, the reason what made that night so special is that Tom really kind of embraced playing some of those old ones. And you could tell physically, and maybe he was acting, I don't know, but it just didn't seem like it was a chore that he was having to play them. And they've just played an incredible set list. It was a great night.
We were there.
Yeah, we were there.
Absolutely fantastic. It really was stunning, that gig. And we came up and there was somebody with us who was, I'm not a big Radiohead fan. And, you know, about an hour in, I looked across at my brother and it's like dribble going down both sides, jaw hanging open. It's like, this is so good. It was fantastic. It really was great. And it was lovely to see Clive climb up there.
What a player! What a player! We when I was at his place recently, he had his Radiohead kit there. I think it was his Radiohead kit, and we started playing There, which is one of my favourite Radiohead songs. And he's literally playing the part in front of me. It was a pinch yourself moment. It's great stuff. Actually, the other one I always mention as well when I answer this is, and it might seem an unusual one when I first say it, but the first concert I ever went to, I was 4 or 5 years old, and my parents managed to somehow get tickets to when Michael Jackson played the Bad Tour at Wembley Stadium, which was enormous gigs. And I know he's a very controversial character, but enormous gigs. And there was genuine, it felt like hysteria, there was like people, they had British Red Cross there because people were fainting so much. And it was just like this, and I can't think of an example in my life since that's happened. And I would just, it was such a hysterical environment to be in because Princess Diana was in the audience, that kind of thing. And actually, if you watch like any of the videos from back then, you see all that stuff. So that was just such a unique experience. It was like the whole Wembley Stadium being plugged in, you know, and turned up the vault. So that would be one that I probably would find really interesting to re-experience. Thank you for asking. That's really kind of you to ask.
That kind of pop hysteria is something else, isn't it, to experience? I mean, I've had my pop years experiencing that sort of thing, and it is absolutely extraordinary. And that noise of 20 odd thousand people all screaming at the same time at the same frequency, so you can't hear anything. Literally, your ears just shut down. Just incredible to watch. It's like people's faces melting.
Yeah, it felt like to me it was one of the early Beatles shows or like an Elvis show or something like that. It just felt like it was this event. That's why it's quite a special one for me. But I was so young, I don't really remember too much of it, but a few memories. So we'll begin to wrap up. Last couple of questions. So in the same way as we now all kind of look back in our youth and think, oh, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I should have done more of X, Y, and Z. If you fast forward to what you'll be doing in, say, 20, 25 years, what do you think your older self will be looking back and going, you should have done more of that at this time of your career or less of it? What do you think your older self will be saying you should have done more during coronavirus or around this time or less of in 25 years?
That's a really tough question, because as you consider those things, then you should be bloody well go and do them.
That's the reason I asked it.
It is the reason. Yeah, well, after years and years and years, I've never made a solo album, so I'm actually making one at the end of this year. I've been writing, so I'm going to do that. And it's ridiculous that I've never done it before. I've written loads for other people and just never done it. And it's like, oh, well, I never want to be on the front. Actually, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yeah, I do, actually. And, and it's not wanting, it's not some kind of Trump-esque, diva thing. It's just wanting to make my own record. So I'll be happy with that.
And Fraser answered exactly the same. No word of a lie. He answered exactly the same.
My boy.
But we then explored, like, what has stopped over that time? Like, what stopped you from doing that? You know, bit of imposter syndrome, bit kind of thinking. It could be all of that stuff. Might not be, but there's probably some kind of deep something under the surface that's stopping you. But
take that risk.
Underestimate the power of imposter syndrome.
Everyone has imposter.
Everyone's got it.
Take the plunge, take the risk.
Rather large artists who've mid-tour had a psychological plunge where they've had serious imposter syndrome. I am not going to name any names, but it goes with the territory. So 20 years time, Kerry, don't say being married to me. That's
no, 20 years time. Yeah,
regret.
Absolutely. I don't know. It's a really good question, and it's really hard. I mean, I didn't start our label. I didn't get into this business until I was already in my mid-40s. So 20 years' time, I'm thinking, hopefully I'll be able to have retired by then. But I wish I'd got into it earlier. I absolutely do. You know, I did a lot of other things in my earlier career. So I do wish I'd got into this earlier, because when I did, I found like I'd finally found my tribe. You know, it was suddenly like, this is where all the people that are like me are. And I've been searching for them for quite a long time, you know. And if only I'd known, this is where they were. So I think in 20 years, you know, I'd love to still be doing what I'm doing, but I'm not sure that anybody would listen to me at, you know, at that age.
Why not? You know, and this is something that...
Well, actually, having said that...
This industry does have this obsession with age.
Having
it's
said
so
that,
tedious.
My mother, who was 92 last week, she's a vocal coach for musical theatre. And up until the pandemic shut down her teaching, she's still teaching. And we recorded an album of her teaching a couple of years ago. So, you know, she was still actively teaching up to the age of 91. And so if she can do it, I suppose I'd better, really.
And my mother's gone around the block.
Your mum's still touring at 85.
Well, it's almost that she's gone around the bend, but she's 30 years old. And she's 85, and she's now, it's this made this weird transition where she's now considered a national treasure. It's really, really strange for her because she's obviously like all of us. It's like, well, I'm still 18 in my head. I haven't changed. National schmeasure doesn't mean anything. So I think the only regret that I'd have was not being able to do this anymore, and I don't see why I shouldn't be able to. Like I was just about to rant, the ageism in this industry is just so tedious.
Did I interrupt your rant?
No.
So, I mean, that might bring on, come to my final question, which is a question we ask all artists who appear on this podcast. What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might you address those fears?
Well, I think from you know the date we're talking, you know, I think we're all pretty terrified about the decimation of live and when it's going to come back and when we'll be able to tour safely and when audiences can come to experience live music, you know, because it's such a big thing.
And the leeching
people.
Of skills, you know, and it's not just paying lip service to it, because I've been a professional touring musician most of my life, but lampies, riggers, truckers, front of house, monitors, PA crew, chippies. It's such a phalanx of people. And they're such tight crews. They're such hard-working people. And a lot of those skills, you know, certainly the infrastructure's in danger. That's a fear in the midst of all of this.
Oh, one of the things that actually I find really encouraging is the amount of information and education there is out there for young artists, for young musicians, for those who want to get into the business side of things. I think, you know, the fantastic amount of information and education that they can avail themselves of is brilliant. And there's never been a better time to educate yourself about, you know, the work you're going into. So in a sense, there's no excuse to be naive, except we're all naive because you don't know what you don't know. Fears, ask me again in a year's time and I can probably give you a better answer.
It is difficult right now because, yeah, we're in the middle. As we record this, it's the 9th of November. We've just started a second lockdown and no one knows what's next. But,
And we're in that situation. We're looking at, you know, first lockdown came, I had 3 months touring knocked on the head and nothing's been necessarily rebooked at this point.
And a couple of the venues that we've got, you know, we had a tour booked into, a couple of the venues have already gone down. Who knows whether those venues are still going to be there next year when we, you know, do the rescheduled tour.
That's a big existential fear. I didn't mean to sound like an old bloke going, oh, you know, these days, record music going. I mean, it's been incredibly liberating, the fact that I think it's now in the general consciousness that there's more than one record industry. It's not just one record industry. It's not just Radio 1 pop music. You know, we have the glory that is Six. We have so many other outlets now that we didn't have when I was growing up, and I think that's fantastic. Technology, I'm an engineer and a producer, so I'm very aware of technology. I use it all the time. I worry about it getting in the way of the music. I always worry about that. But then I guess my dad would have said the same thing.
It's all in a cycle. We are going to wrap up there. I'd just like to say thanks so much to both of you for your collective wisdom, your collective guidance and sharing experiences from kind of both sides of the fence, and shining a light on knowledge that all young musicians may need, you know, that is perhaps as critical or arguably even more critical than the unique set of skill sets they might have in regards to their musical instrument, for instance. Get that solo album done, Callum.
I will. No, I'm going to. I have to. I've said it now. I can't unsay it.
And then get Fraser to do his one as well, because that was what he answered that a year ago. And I'm, as far as I know, he hasn't done it yet. So, and thank you to Kerry for your wisdom as well. It's been really, really fascinating. Good luck with, I mean, any new projects you've got coming up that you'd like to tell us about, or is it just what's happening at the moment for you guys?
Yeah, two of my artists got new albums coming out next year. Calm's mum, Peggy Seeger, has a new album.
Which
Calm's produced. It's a fantastic album. And that it's likely it will be her final original album, all original songs, and a masterpiece, I think. I mean, genuinely, I think it's a masterpiece. Another of my artists, Luke Concannon, who was one half of Nisloppy, he's got an album coming out in February. And again, really good album, some fantastic songs on that. And, you know, he's a really class songwriter and performer.
Jake Morley, you've got a new album coming out. I know you don't manage him anymore, but
no,
he's a good mate of ours.
Jake's got, yeah, absolutely. Jake will have a lovely album out as well.
He's great.
Good stuff. It sounds like you've been involved in some interesting projects during this somewhat downtime, and here's to 2021. So thanks for being such great guest on the Stage Left podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Chris. That was good fun. Thank you.
Yeah.